Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com.
Joining me today is, well, many writers, but just one person. Claire North, Kate Griffin, Catherine Webb, winner of this year's Campbell Award for Best Science Fiction Novel, writer of over a dozen YA novels and novels for adults, twice nominated for the Carnegie Award, and most recently acclaimed for The First 15 Lives of Harry August and The Equally Wonderful Touch. Catherine, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you for having me.
Now, shall I call you Catherine all throughout, or shall we just...
Why not?
Why not?
Good at responding to Kate or Claire yet.
Now, I had no idea when I read your last two novels that you had started writing and being published at the age of 14 with the first novel called Mirror of Dreams. Lots of teenagers write stories, of course, but hardly any of them get published and then go on to have these successful, prolific writing careers.
Yeah, I wish I had a glamorous explanation. I was an only child. I lived in the library. One day there weren't any books left in the fantasy shelf in the library. Yeah, it's not a glamorous story. I wish that it was.
But that's it? You were in the library and you decided you needed to write a book that you couldn't find? Well, that's often how it starts, isn't it?
It pretty much. I think that's how everyone starts writing. It's just I'd spent a lot of time in the library. I used to go to the Barbican Library in the centre of London. And it was kind of my reward for attending violin lessons. I'd play the violin badly for an hour and I'd be allowed to sit in the library. And I worked from Douglas Adams down to Roger Zelazny, and there was a terrible moment when there wasn't anything left after Zelazny. And it was literally a thing of, I might have to start writing in order to keep myself happy. And I did that for a while, and I wrote many things before I was 14, which were unspeakably bad. And then by the time I was 14, kind of was writing longer stuff and accidentally ended up writing a book, which was surreal, but not probably as surreal as it being published. There were many surreal coincidences involved. I would love to be able to say that it was anything involving destiny or talent. It really wasn't. It was blind luck.
Have you read your first book again recently?
No, absolutely not. I have no desire to go there. I suspect if I read it, I'll discover that as a 14-year-old, I didn't have the wisdom of Bertrand Russell or the charisma of Lauren Bacall. I just don't want to know.
Did you think you did when you were 14?
No, in fairness. But there is that thing when you look back on your life, and I'm now 29, so in my lofty old age, I look back on my life and I look back at who I was when I was 14, and I can understand the decisions I made, but it's sometimes as if the thought processes were foggy, as if I really have to strain my imagination to remember why I made those decisions, what I was thinking, how I felt, to understand what it was like when I was 14. It's still me, it's still there, but it's obscured by the fact that I have changed so much in all that time that it is a slightly different me. I'm not necessarily a me that I want to claim ownership of right now at this point in my life.
For what it's worth, probably none at all. I can't quite remember 29.
I'm quite looking forward to 30. I still have this problem that I look and act like a 7-year-old, and so wherever I go, people are constantly going, oh, congratulations on your first novel, and you're very young, you must be very excited, and I am genuinely excited every time a book comes out, but it is also, by this point in my career, kind of 16th, 17th books that are hitting the shelves, and I'm a bit like, yeah, one day I won't like 7, and we'll have a different kind of conversation.
Oh, no, trust me, when you're 38, you'll be glad to look like 7. It's fine. But now, you, as you just said, you've been pretty prolific over the last, you know, decade and a half or so. I assume this to mean that you're also very disciplined. Are you? Are you like a serious plotter? Do you know what you're doing right before you get to typing?
No, not really. I think there are two ways you can probably be prolific, if that's what I am. I think you can be relentlessly disciplined, or you can constantly wing it with a great amount of joy and glee, and I'm definitely in the latter camp. I don't completely wing it. I, with everything I write, I know what I'm writing about, who I'm writing about, and I have a rough idea of where it goes. But one of the ways in which I stay interested is by not necessarily having every detail of how it'll get there mapped out. I quite like that moment where you realise it's gone in a completely different direction because of the way the character is, because of the way events have developed. And I'm fine with that, and I'm happy to let that be the thing that motivates me, the surprise of finding out what will happen.
Now tell me about your many names and the need or the choice to have pseudonyms. The first pseudonym was Kate Griffin, if I'm right, when you moved to writing urban fantasy. And then from there to Claire North.
So there's lots of things at work, I think, in the pseudonyms. I don't mind at all my name not being on the books. I'm in this job for cash, not fame, which I think my mum would tell me is a silly life choice, but never mind.
I was wondering how that works, yes.
Yeah, I think there are other options I could have taken down that path, but I love it, so I can't complain. So I don't mind my name not being on books, and part of the reasoning for having a pseudonym was to distinguish how the books have changed as I have changed. So I was Catherine Webb, I was myself for the young adult books. Because I was a young adult, I was writing books that appealed to me, and I've always written books that appeal to me. And then when I got kind of 20, 21, I started writing urban fantasy, and they were different enough from the young adult that it wasn't a guarantee that the readers who enjoy my 14-year-old, 15-year-old books would enjoy them. And so having that pseudonym was just a quick and easy way of distinguishing between one style of writing and another. And that was an open pseudonym. You could still see it was me. You could still hunt me down and go, aha, I shall buy all of her books under all of her names, or not. But it was just a quick and easy way of breaking them apart. And then when I started writing as Claire North, it was again because there's a different style of writing happening in the books. And that was supposed to be a closed pseudonym, and then it very quickly wasn't. So it's just a, I think it's a quick shorthand for the readers to know that it's a different style of writing. And it was very much something my publisher was keen on doing, and I had no strong feelings on the subject either way, except to keep the first names, the Kate, the Claire, vaguely close to Catherine, because when people come up to me these days and say, hello, Miss Griffin, or hello, Claire, I still have about a 10-second satellite delay between them saying to me, going, oh, right, yes, me, hello.
That's interesting that you had no opinion on it either way, and interesting that your publisher wanted that, because there are writers who, of course, write, you know, as time goes by, and they write different sorts of things and move on from young adult to, you know, books for adults, or backwards as well, and they don't change their names.
Yes, I think that's a perfectly valid thing to do from kind of a commercial point of view. I think there's many advantages and disadvantages of having pseudonyms. I think one of the big obvious disadvantages is that if you have a readership who's really enjoyed Kate Griffin books, for example, they may not even be aware of Claire North books. And so by changing your name, you actually risk losing readers who might otherwise have enjoyed your work.
Right.
On the other, there are all the advantages of keeping the voices separate. So I can see pros and cons to it. I had no strong feelings because, to be honest, once I've written the book, I have made quite conscious decisions throughout my life to not necessarily get too emotionally involved in the publishing decisions that then follow. As a scribbler, the most I can do and the best I can do is to write the books that I think are the best I can write. And I'm quite, not exactly cynical, but I'm quite conscious that what power I have beyond that moment is very limited, and the role of a publisher is to be more intelligent about that sort of thing than I might be. So I'm quite detached when it comes to those sorts of commercial decisions about whether to change a name, whether to keep a name, whether the style of book has changed enough to be on a different shelf. All of that, I think there are people who are probably more involved and have more skill in that than I do.
Now, you were saying just earlier that you wrote young adult novels while you were still quite young yourself. You were a young adult, as it were. I suppose in one way, you know, you could say being a young adult gave you an edge or an understanding or a more, you know, of connection to the audience you were writing for. But at the same time, it must have been pretty stressful as well to have the series of books is existing and then the pressures that come with that while you're still quite young. Was it tough?
Not as tough as you might have expected, I suspect, simply because at the time I was writing, and I still do write to relax. It's my escape from the realities of this world, and it's a thing I do for fun and for joy. And so as kind of a 15 or 16 year old, I was going through the exam system in this country, which involved doing lots of subjects I was really, really bad at, like German, where I was just a disaster. And it was quite nice to get away from the stress of that real life and have something that I could do just for me and just relax and just to stay calm. And writing became that. And then all the stuff that comes with writing, kind of the marketing and the attention that you do get as a teenage writer. Thankfully, because I was young, a lot of that was quite well managed, so I was quite protected within it, if that makes sense. There was a very strong sense from certainly my parents and also from my publisher that what I would do would be within a safety cushion. It wouldn't interfere with exams. It would be within holidays. It wouldn't be kind of difficult touring or difficult questioning. It would all be fairly fluffy, really. And so I kind of ended up getting quite a lot of the good bits of all worlds. I was writing for joy. I was kind of being poked at and examined by people who are curious by this fact, but not in a hostile way, but usually in quite a kind of happy way and a kind of surprised and pleased to meet me rather than a good God, what are you doing, teenage child kind of way. And at the same time, like, I was earning a bit from it, and that was money I could use to go to university later. So there was a sense that, yes, this is a serious, important thing, but this is also an opportunity more than it is a burden.
And you also ended up being one of those rare child stars that grew up okay. It doesn't happen very often, does it?
I'm sure I've got plenty of neuroses, and I definitely wasn't a child star. I mean, I'm going to sit here now and think about all the things that I could probably list in my life. I'm actually struggling to think of things in my life that are particularly traumatic. I've had quite a happy childhood and quite a happy life. But I'll work something out, don't you worry.
I'll give you another 10 years and we'll get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Your last novel was Touch, which was in parts both an exciting thriller and fairly philosophical as well at times. I really enjoyed it. Will you tell us a little bit about where that came from?
Yay, thank you for enjoying it. So, Touch, because I'm quite a gung-ho writer, I suspect a lot of my ideas don't formulate in an easily logical way. So specifically with Touch, I can tell you the exact time and place where the idea for the story hit, which was a couple of winters ago, walking to a rehearsal in London. So as well as being a writer, I am a theatre lighting designer, so I spend a lot of my time going to darkened rooms at silly hours. And I was walking to one of these, and it was dead cold and dark and foggy, and there was the beginning of snow. I remember looking to my left and seeing a park, and in this park there were street lights on, and it being snowy, kind of snowy and misty, there were people kind of moving in and out of the light, kind of figures appearing in the light and then vanishing in the darkness, and you couldn't see which way they were going. You couldn't quite work out which path they were going to walk down as they appeared and vanished and appeared and vanished. All you could see were shapes moving, and you could make an educated guess as to where they might next appear. And sometimes you'd be right and sometimes you'd be wrong as you watched these figures moving through the park. I remember seeing that, and at that moment having the idea for writing Touch. And I struggle to this day to tell you why, to tell you what it was about that moment that made me think, yes, this book, these characters, this place. But that was honestly that moment, that sight. And I can still remember kind of seeing the fog and the park and the figures and the light. I don't really have a better answer, I'm afraid. I wish I did.
Did it all really come to you all together, the characters, the setting, the whole premise?
Not the plot. Plot is something which I do have to sit and think about a bit more, simply to fight against my own gung-ho qualities. But the broad outlines of it and the nature of what the story should be, that was all fairly quick. By the time I'd finished walking to rehearsals, I was pretty set on kind of the voice and the world and the characters. That was all pretty much there. Partly, I think, because the story itself leaves only so many things you can push at in an interesting way. There are certain themes that just automatically emerge from the premise, and it's just a question of pulling on those threads until something interesting pops.
Now, avoiding all spoilers, or as many as I can, of course, but in Harry August, we had a protagonist who relives his life again and again. In Touch, we had a protagonist who can jump bodies, who occupies different lives and lives many different lives all over the world over centuries. The books aren't, I mean, I wouldn't say they were similar, but yet they're, you know, still sort of a pair. Are you interested in this, I wanted to know, this idea of sort of reincarnation as it was, or is it more about thinking about what it's like to live with regret, being able to start fresh or, you know, relive your life again, which I suppose really is what reincarnation lets you do?
I think I'm interested in how different people see the world. One of the joys of writing Harry August, and indeed of writing Kepler, the main character from Touch, is that their situations allow them to see things in a completely different way. Harry August, by dint of being born and living and dying, Since he's always being born again as himself, he gets to look at the grand events of history through the eyes of someone who's already seen them. He's not surprised by the development of the nuclear bomb. He's not surprised by Vietnam. He's not surprised by any of the great events of the 20th century. He just sits there and can see, in many ways, the fallacy that retrospect gives you. His entire life, in many ways, is a gift of retrospect. And we all of us talk about looking back on our lives with the wisdom of hindsight. His entire existence is the wisdom of hindsight, which completely changes how he sees not just history, but people and the world and the things people invest in. Marriage means something different to him. Childhood means something different to him. Everything that we take for granted for him is seen through hindsight and is therefore completely changed. And with Kepler in touch, because Kepler moves from body to body, Kepler perceives bodies in a completely different way from us. Kepler doesn't just see someone else leading their life. Kepler sees a life which it could lead, which completely changes the dynamic of just how you look at the world. And so I guess I liked these characters for the opportunity they gave to poke at things which are taken for granted and really have fun with them.
Tell me a little bit about your research. I know you have a background in history, but does that come into play when you write about people sort of reliving lives or living lives at different times of the world?
It comes into play, I suspect, both consciously and unconsciously. There's very conscious decisions you can make with both Kepler and Harry August. You can look at bits of history and go, this is interesting. What would happen if I plonked this character in that situation with this set of rules, with this knowledge? How will they look at that bit of history? And indeed, how will we as readers look at that bit of history through these eyes? So you can make certain conscious decisions about which bits of history to poke at. For example, with Harry August, I am okay when it comes to history of the Cold War, but I have this great void when it comes to a cultural history of the 1970s. I just got nothing. I'm okay up to 1969, I'm fine from 1981, but I've just got this sort of mental block on the intervening years. And so if you look at the book, I suspect you'll find that I kind of dodge that decade a bit. So there's lots of conscious decisions just about time and place. I think there's also quite a lot of unconscious influences which comes from history. One of the reasons I chose to study history rather than English is because I think history is full of absolutely stunning stories that in many ways you couldn't get away with in fiction. Just some of the scale of human events is breathtaking and defies writing about in any sort of way that you can almost connect with on a human scale. For example, if you read about, I don't know, take the Second World War, you kind of read words like 22 million Soviet citizens died in the Second World War, and that means almost nothing just as words on a page. And it takes reading history and reading primary sources to begin to connect with something human there. So I love history for the power of the stories it can tell. I also love history for some of the absurdities it shows, some of the human decisions that have been made. And again, with hindsight, you look back and go, really? Really? No, but really, was that a good idea? And you can look at all these moments in human history and go, well, that was absurd. But at the same time, you can understand how it happened. And I find that fascinating. I find kind of the things that humanity has done to itself down the centuries, and the mad things it's done to itself, but also the very logical things it's done while being mad. Absolutely fantastic.
Are you ever going to go back to young adult or urban fantasy of the sort that you were writing before you became Claire North?
I genuinely don't know. I wouldn't ever say no to it because I really enjoyed writing young fantasy and urban fantasy. I'd probably be more likely to go back to urban fantasy. But it's almost a question of finding the time. And also, I think, it's a question of momentum, in the sense that right now I'm writing a lot of Claire North books, which do have their own style. And while that is still something which interests me, it makes sense to kind of ride that wave. So I genuinely don't know. I would like to. I think, to a degree, some of that may also be influenced by this mysterious thing called film, because there are a few people who've been vaguely interested in trying to make stuff as a movie, and it being film, I have no confidence that any of it will ever happen. I'd be breathtakingly excited if it did, but I'm not counting any chickens at all. But if, for example, someone did succeed in making a Kate Griffin book, that would probably make it more likely I went back to that world. But I genuinely don't know. I'm kind of playing it by ear, I'm afraid.
Well, now I know you trained at RADA, was it? And you work, as you said, as a lighting designer as well. I've been wondering if your work there for the stage ever connects or plays into your writing fiction as well.
Again, I think a bit like history, it probably does in a very unconscious way. One of my favourite quotes is Tom Lehrer, who, when asked about mathematics, turned around and said, "Plagiarise, but be sure to call it research." I quite strongly believe that writers tend to go through their lives looking at everything around them and meeting people and hearing stuff and going, "Ooh, I can use that," consciously or unconsciously. So I have no doubt that all the things I've seen in theatre and the people I've met and the shows I've worked on have unconsciously influenced me in that kind of, "Ooh, that's interesting, I can use that" way. And it's also, I suspect, influenced me in the sense that one of the reasons I do theatre is very specifically to get out of the house and meet people. I suspect as a writer, if you just write and don't do other things, there's a danger you'll go mad as you sit alone in your flat with your keyboard. And so one of the good things about theatre is I go mad surrounded by other people who are going mad in a theatre, which is great. And so just by meeting people and different people on every different show, I have no doubt that both what I write and who I am is being influenced and changed. And that's kind of one of the points and a good thing.
Now, the obvious thing I must ask now, of course, is, I mean, you clearly seem to love theatre and the stage and you love writing fiction. Have you ever considered writing for the stage?
I have. I've written a couple of plays just for my own joy. I'm not sure if any of them are good. I haven't really pursued it as a big commercial thing. I did get asked to write a play by a director friend of mine, which I thought wasn't the world's greatest bit of writing, really. It fulfilled the brief he gave, but I think it was one of those scripts that's a triumph of form over content. It's very easy in theatre, particularly in a certain kind of devised theatre, to mistake having three people in giant banana suits bouncing up and down while lit in blue light as somehow having meaning rather than form. And I think there's a big danger when you write theatre without necessarily being already embedded in how to write that well, that you end up writing plays which are full of very nice looking things and interesting kind of sentences, but not necessarily a huge amount of meaning. And I think I might have been a bit guilty of that in my early attempts.
Do you have a favourite piece of theatre?
My gut answer, and it's a slightly wacky one, is that one of my all-time favourite plays is Henry IV, Parts 1 and Part 2, can't really decide, by Shakespeare, simply because I remember at quite an early age seeing one of those, a production of Henry IV, and just being unable to breathe. It was so incredibly intense and so good, but also just kind of towards the end, particularly of the second play, just being sat on the edge of my seat thinking, if I don't actually consciously remember to breathe at this point, I probably won't ever breathe again. And so I think it's always embedded in my memory as something that I love, just because it takes that prize place as being one of the first moments that I saw a piece of theatre which left me on the verge of an asthma attack.
Is it something like that that interested you in, or moved you towards an interest in lighting?
I think it was a mixture of things that took me specifically towards lighting. I've always been interested in theatre and in drama, but I've always known that I will never be an actor. I'm not good enough and I'm not interested enough to be an actor. So I was always interested in the technical elements, and I've always enjoyed kind of science. I've never been very good at science, but I've always enjoyed it, and I've always loved colours. I have a thing that my mother also has called synesthesia, whereby certain concepts and words appear in colour. So I guess that's always pushed me towards lighting. And then when I went to RADA, in my first year of training, you basically do everything: construction, design, costume, painting, the whole lot. And hands down, without fail, the second I got into lighting, it was just the one I had to do. But I'm very glad I did the others. I'm very glad that I experienced all of them rather than just went on the hunch that lighting would be my thing.
Now tell me about this dangerous martial art that you've been training in.
Okay, so I learn a Philippine martial art called Eskrima. Although I say that, I learn a slightly corrupted version of that, which in London falls under the umbrella of a thing called a screamer concept, which is basically all the most violent bits of awesome you've ever encountered ever combined into a martial art. And I've been learning it for over 3 years now, I think, which means I'm probably good enough to know that I'm not very good. I think there's a moment after kind of 2 years when you think, yeah, I'm invincible. And then there's a moment about 6 months after that where you think, oh, I've got a lot further to go, haven't I? And I'm definitely at the lot further to go stage. But I really enjoy it. I find it very relaxing. I particularly enjoy learning weapons, which we do a lot of, because I enjoy how sneaky it is. There's very little formality to the martial art. There's no bowing. There's no kind of having to acknowledge your sensei. My teachers are two fantastic blokes called Nigel and Charlie, whose only vices are the fact that they're vegan supporters of Tottenham Hotspur. And it's an incredibly kind of friendly club, but it's also a club which encourages you to think a lot about not merely what you do tactically, but also just about general life situations. So recently we've been teaching a bit of self-defense, and I've been teaching specific little bit of women's self-defense, which is something I'm a big fan of. And it's been probably the highlight of the training, actually, has been meeting women who have never really thought about self-defense and about just kind of common sense awareness of how you approach self-defense, not merely as a physical thing, but as a psychological thing. And just seeing the beginning of them starting to change after a class, just after kind of a few hours of being able to see them thinking differently about awareness and about what they both can do, but also what they are entitled to do when threatened, which I think is a massive part of the conversation about women and martial arts and self-defense. What we as women culturally and socially are willing to accept that we are allowed to do. So yeah, it's been fascinating and it keeps me very happy.
So you're saying you're not that great, but I'm wondering, another year or so, can we rent you out as muscle? Or will you rent yourself out as muscle? You know, for the famous actors on stage, or the famous writers at cons, they all need some.
Yeah, I think surprisingly, I think a lot of writers at cons are probably okay. I think a lot of writers, certainly based on the ones I've met, have at some point done something violent, jiu-jitsu or ninjutsu, something that makes them feel like awesome, fighty type people. And as for actors, I hate to say it, as a technician, I sort of feel they've got it coming.
Oh no, that's horrible. No one's going to hire you now.
Sorry.
Not for this, not for muscle. All right, so what are we to expect next from you? Or should I ask, who are we expecting the next book from?
The next book is still definitely Claire North. After that, who knows? So currently there are three novellas, which are Claire North novellas, which are being released as ebooks and an audiobook in November, I think, which I'm counting as a whole book, because when you take them together, they're quite long. Separately, they're nice bite-sized chunks, but they took a while. So there's three novellas, and then in, I think, February maybe of next year, February or March, sometime next year early-ish, is the third Claire North book, which I'm currently attempting to edit right now, which is really still far too long at this stage of edits, but that's fine, deletion is my friend, which is the story of a woman who everyone forgets and all the complexities that arise from that.
But tell me, who's publishing the novellas?
It's my same publisher as always. The novellas... True story about the novellas. The novellas were proposed to me by my current editor, who I love, in the stationery cupboard of Blackwell's Bookshop on Tottenham Court Road, because there was going to be a slight delay as we moved from Kate Griffin to Claire North books, and my agent had been a bit like, you will publish more stuff by my client or else. And so my editor racked her brains thinking, what can we do to fill this gap, and was struck by the idea of novellas and so excited by it, but also so worried that it was going to be something I'd reject and therefore an idea that wouldn't fly, that she dragged me into this cup saying, we can't tell anyone, oh my god, I really hope you're as excited by this as I am. And we had a top secret conversation in the stationery cupboard, and I was as excited as she was.
But they're actually coming out after the, you know, the first two Claire North books came out.
Yeah, the plan of how it was going to plug the gap in that sense didn't really work out the way we'd planned on it working out. Very few plans in publishing seem to survive first contact with the enemy. But, as I kind of said before, once the writing part is done, I'm not too worried by the rest of it. So, happy they're coming out. They took a bit longer to come out than everyone expected, but I hope they'll be all right.
So is there a reason why you guys picked, you and your publishers, was picked ebooks instead of going the more traditional route with print books as well?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I suspect that my publisher would be able to give a better answer than me. From my point of view, I suspect that the ebooks thing is perhaps, in its own cautious way, a reflection on how much publishing is changing at the moment. So iTunes, Amazon, Kindles, Kobo, kind of the whole development of digital publishing and the arise, kind of the storming rising up of the internet and of self-publishing, I think means that traditional print and paperback publishing feels under threat. And people still want books, people still love books, but how people receive books is changing. And as a result, how the entire economic system works is changing. And I think there are some arguments that novellas and short stories are rising up in popularity simply because they are something you can download in 2 seconds to an e-reader or a smartphone. Whether that's the case, I'm not sure. I suspect it's probably more complicated than that. But I also think that all publishers right now are trying to get to grips with this new digital market, and some ideas are succeeding and some aren't. It is possible that these novellas will be sacrificed to the gods of the internet. It is possible, alternatively, that they will actually be a successful thing that teach all of us, myself and my publishers, something about how digital publishing works. I'm not quite sure either way, really.
Sami, what have you read recently that's been really exciting?
Oh, lots of things. Let me have a trawl through my mind. Hilariously, right now I'm reading History of the Popes. Not because it's something I thought would blow my mind, but just because it's something I've been meaning to read for 3 years since I got given it after a history degree. And it's actually kind of wonderful. It's exactly everything I think about history being full of characters you could never get away with in real life. Sorry, in fiction even, you could never get away with them. So I'm currently reading that. I was reading for The Kitches this year, which had actually an incredibly strong fielding of wonderful books on the table. Viper Wine was spectacular. Oh, it's kind of fantastic. Like, it's one of those books where you read it and as a writer you're sat there going, wow, I wish I was that good. So that was kind of wonderful. Europe in Autumn was great. I really enjoyed, even though I it's kind of guilt reading because I'm not sure if it's world-shatteringly awesome, but I've really enjoyed Wolfhound Century and that kind of series of books. It's been just fun. Like, communism meets Eastern European magic. It's just a lovely place to begin a story, and it's kind of like, yeah, this makes me happy. So I've really enjoyed that series lately. I really enjoyed Tiger Man. I would love to say that I've enjoyed the books of James Smythe, but enjoyment isn't quite the right word because you do come away from them thinking, oh, the bleakness of the human
this
spirit.
This is very true because I just finished Way Down Dark 2 days ago.
And, I haven't read this one yet. Well, I need to. It's on the list.
I'm quite bereft, I have to tell you. But this is what I love Smythe for.
I was reading No Harm Can Come to a Good Man, and it's one of those books that's utterly compelling. Yeah. I kind of read it going, I think this book might not only be brilliant but also have something really quite important to say about the modern world.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you do come away from it just going, ah, the futility of humanity. So I think pretty much everything he writes is kind of wonderful like that.
All right, so hopefully we will speak to you again when the next book is out, no matter who you may be that day.
That would be lovely. Thank you
so much for taking the time out to talk to me today.
Thank you for having me.